Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Vice President Joe Biden, accompanied by Attorney General Eric Holder, Secretary Hilda Solis, Ms. Valerie Garrett, Ms. Melody Barnes, Chairwoman Jacqueline Berry, and Ms. Lynn Lesley.
Well, good morning, everyone. Good morning. I can see we are here with friends and enthusiastic allies. Welcome to the White House. I would first like to thank Vice President Biden for bringing us all here together this morning and to talk about and to celebrate the important work that's been happening because of all of your help. And we're here this morning because of President Obama's commitment to ensuring equality for American women, to ensuring that our daughters have the same opportunities as our sons, and importantly, to ensuring that when women have these opportunities, when they're doing the same work that a man is doing, that they get equal pay for equal work. We're also working to address the challenges men and women face as they juggle work and family. Back in March, we held a forum to discuss the ways that we can create workplace practices that allow America's working men and women to meet the demands of their jobs without sacrificing the needs of their families. There are ways to make this balancing act work better for employees and employers alike, and leading businesses are already showing us the way. They're using creative and alternative work schedules, part-time or job-sharing arrangements, and telework options to reduce commuting time. Ensuring equal pay, balancing work and family life, all of these issues and more have been at the heart of the work of the Middle Class Task Force. We know that women make only 77 cents on the dollar that a man makes. This means that women lose thousands of dollars in salary, income, and savings over a lifetime. And in 2010, when women make up over half of the workforce, two-thirds of American families with children rely on a woman's wages as a significant portion of the family income. As we emerge from one of the worst recessions in American history, when families are struggling to pay their bills and save for the future, pay inequality only deepens the struggle and hampers our economy's ability to fully recover. The very last thing that our families can afford is less take-home pay because of discrimination. That's why the very first bill the president signed was the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. By doing so, the president fulfilled his campaign promise and confirmed his commitment to addressing wage discrimination. But we cannot rest on our laurels. There's more work to do. There's always more work to do. So in January, in his State of the Union address, the president called for a crackdown in the violations of equal pay laws. We brought together the Department of Labor, the Department of Justice, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the Office of Personnel Management to create the National Equal Pay Enforcement Task Force. And that task force has worked over the last months to develop recommendations and an action plan that we are here to discuss today. So let me very briefly tell you a little bit about the work. First, the task force determined that federal enforcement was fractured across agencies. In response, we're establishing a standing working group to improve coordination and communication among the agencies, coordinate investigations and litigation, and identify areas where the agencies can issue guidance to employees or employers and conduct joint training as appropriate. Second, although we know that women only earn 77 cents on the dollar, the federal government does not systematically collect gender-identified data on wages. This lack of data makes identifying wage discrimination difficult and undercuts enforcement efforts. Both the Department of Labor and the EEOC will evaluate their data collection needs and develop strategies to improve data collection. Third, we need to communicate with people who are impacted by and have the power to change wage discrimination. We will undertake an important public education campaign to educate employees on their rights and employers on their obligations. We'll also work to improve the kind of wage data that we can share with the public to give women more tools to know whether they are receiving the pay that they deserve. Fourth, the federal government will work to make itself a model employer. We're going to walk the walk. Although there is a smaller wage gap between men and women who are employed by the government, we can do more to reduce this gap and improve the number of women serving in the senior executive service. Last, just as the President encouraged the Senate to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act, the task force does as well. You know, the Equal Pay Act was an historical milestone, but let's get real. It was passed in 1963. It is time to look forward. It's time, after nearly 50 years of shifting women's workforce roles and family responsibilities, to build on this cornerstone of equality. I look forward to working with all of you and with all of my colleagues gathered here today to make sure that happens. And now I want to thank you for being here and to turn this over to the Attorney General of the United States, Attorney General Eric Holder. Thank you.
Well, good morning. And thank you, Melody. It's an honor to stand with these leaders and with Vice President Biden as we take a critical step forward in fulfilling our nation's promise to equal opportunity and to equal treatment. Together, we have developed a plan and we have renewed our commitment to finally closing the wage gap between men and women. This problem is unacceptable, but it is not intractable. The recommendations released today by the Equal Pay Task Force provide a framework for coordinating and for strengthening both our enforcement and our public education efforts. President Obama has called for more aggressive enforcement of our equal pay laws. The Justice Department and our law enforcement partners are fully committed to answering this call and to fulfilling our enforcement responsibilities, but we cannot do it alone. That's why all of the enforcement agencies that are represented here today, the Department of Justice, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission, and the Department of Labor, plan to take aggressive and strategic action through investigations, litigation, policy guidances, data analysis, and public education efforts to advance this critical priority. With better coordination and increased collaboration, I am confident that our agencies will be able to improve compliance with laws barring wage discrimination and, as a result, make meaningful progress in closing the wage gap. Now, I'd like to mention just a few of the specific steps that the Justice Department is taking. In conjunction with the EEOC and four of its district offices, the Department has launched a robust and intensive pilot program to coordinate the investigation and litigation of charges against state and local government employers. This program is focused on establishing strategic priorities and leveraging our joint resources to ensure that the most effective investigations possible. Now, through this initiative, we are working to identify high-priority charges against state and local government employers, including pattern or practice charges and other charges that will benefit substantial numbers of employees or establish new principles of law. And we're working together to determine the most effective ways of bringing offending employers into compliance with the law. We plan to thoroughly evaluate this pilot program and assess whether best practices for this type of collaboration can be extended to other regions. The Justice Department is also working closely with the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs to improve enforcement of Executive Order 11246, which bans discrimination in employment by federal contractors. Our agencies are sharing both resources and expertise to ensure that no company receiving the benefit of a federal contract is allowed to violate the civil rights of its workers. These collaborations make sense, and by encouraging more information sharing and more effective resource management, they will help us make the progress that every American and every working woman deserves. Today, together, we are sending a message that the federal government is serious about ensuring equal pay for equal work. This is a civil rights issue, and I assure you, this is a law enforcement priority. And the Justice Department is committed to ensuring that federal employees charged with enforcing our anti-discrimination laws have the resources and the training necessary to evaluate wage disparities and to investigate and to litigate wage discrimination cases. Now, generations of Americans have taken up this challenge. Today, we honor their efforts by redoubling our own. Now, I am committed to implementing the solutions that we need to finally close the wage gap. Through stronger and more strategic partnerships, I look forward to the time when all of us will accomplish all we want in the days ahead. And now I'd like to turn this over to one of the Justice Department's key partners, Jackie Berrien, who is the chair of the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission. Thank you.
Good morning. I'm delighted to represent the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission at this event today, highlighting the important work the administration and federal agencies are doing to improve life for all workers. I would like to thank Vice President Biden for his leadership of the Middle Class Task Force, Valerie Jarrett for her leadership of the White House Council on Women and Girls, Melody Barnes for leadership of the Domestic Policy Council and Equal Pay Task Force work, and finally, I acknowledge Commissioner and former Acting Chair Stuart Ishimaru, who represented the EEOC in the early months of the task force's work. The EEOC plays a leading role in enforcing our nation's wage discrimination laws in both public and private sector workplaces. The EEOC has served the public for 45 years, and in that time, our work has helped transform the nation's workplaces and achieve justice for countless individuals. As a federal agency responsible for investigating violations of the Equal Pay Act and Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we have a bird's eye view of the ways in which the promise of equal pay for equal work remains unfulfilled for so many women across the country. Our national commitment to equal employment opportunity will not be achieved until women are recognized as equal partners in every workplace. The EEOC's work to eliminate wage discrimination has never been more important. Over the last three fiscal years, the EEOC has seen a 30% increase in charges of wage discrimination based on sex. Through our administrative enforcement process alone, the EEOC obtained about $19 million in relief for victims of wage discrimination in fiscal year 2009. The Commission is currently litigating 14 cases that include allegations of sex-based wage discrimination. Recently, and fortunately, our work has been fortified by budget increases we have received over the last two fiscal years. From 2000 to 2008, the EEOC's staffing level declined by 25%, while our charges rose to historically high levels. With the additional $14.6 million in 2009 and $23.4 million in 2010, we have been able to hire over 200 frontline investigators, mediators, attorneys, and other staff who do the hard work every day of investigating, litigating, and resolving charges of discrimination across the country. We have increased our training budget. We have started the process of rebuilding, and we hope to continue to grow and build on this excellent beginning. We take our enforcement responsibilities in the area of wage discrimination very seriously, and we will work closely with our partners here today, the Department of Justice, the Department of Labor, the Office of Personnel Management, to address instances of wage discrimination to the fullest extent possible under current law. When President Obama signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act, he expressed his hope that the act would help his daughters and others who follow them to grow up in a nation that values their contributions, where there are no limits to their dreams, and they have opportunities their mothers and grandmothers never could have imagined. The Ledbetter Act provided the EEOC with important tools in the fight for equal pay, but we hope the Congress will act soon to continue this forward momentum through the passage of the Paycheck Fairness Act. We will also continue to work with our other important partners in this work, the employers, human resource professionals, civil rights advocates across the country, all of whom have a stake in maintaining workplaces that are free of unlawful discrimination. We look forward to working with all of you today to realize the promise of equal pay for equal work for every worker in the United States of America. I thank you, and now I would like to introduce Secretary of Labor of the United States, Hilda Solis.
Thank you. Good morning. Buenos dias. Thank you, Jacqueline, for that nice introduction. And I want to thank everyone for joining us here today. I am so proud of what this administration is doing. And I want to thank all of my colleagues who have come together to work on behalf of working families. It's always an honor to work with the Middle Class Task Force, led by our wonderful friend and colleague, muy amigo, Vice President Joe Biden. President Barack Obama called us all together to create Equal Pay Enforcement Task Force because he believes that a strong nation is made up of strong families. The new Department of Labor is ensuring pay equity is a high priority. And over the past year, the Office of Federal Contract Compliance Programs has investigated and resolved a number of cases involving compensation discrimination. For example, we have won cases for women finance managers who were paid less than their male counterparts and for women software developers as well. And currently, our solicitor is litigating a case of systemic discrimination for women pharmaceutical sales reps. And I have said in other contexts, the Department of Labor is back in the enforcement business. We are finding cases and winning results, but we can't do it alone, and I am confident that by collaborating with our colleagues at EEOC and the Department of Justice, we can ensure workers facing pay discrimination have the most strategic approaches deployed in their defense. At OFCCP, we're also updating our protocols, training our staff in how to identify patterns of pay discrimination, and we will hire also an additional 200 staff, mostly frontline enforcement. To address this challenge, data is critical. The EO survey was adopted at the end of the Clinton administration and was rescinded in the Bush administration. Legislation is required for it to be reinstated, and the Paycheck Fairness Act calls for new data collection. We're taking steps now. OFCCP will seek input from advocates and businesses on how the prior EO survey can be improved to gather better data to limit the burden of data collection on employers. The Department of Labor will also work closely with EEOC and reinvigorate our programs for public education so employers know their responsibilities and employees know their rights. OFCCP will launch new outreach and education efforts targeted to workers so that they can understand their rights under the law and how OFCCP can be of help. The Women's Bureau will create publications on earnings gap and resources for workers, including an equal pay checklist, while revamping our widely used equal pay employer self-audit tool. And our Women's Bureau will also host equal pay research summits that will bring together advocates, union, business leaders, civil rights leaders, and government officials so we can learn from all of you. As Melody said earlier, these are core working family issues. More money in women's paycheck means less stress on the family budget, and it means another tank of gas or schools for youngsters in our family. One of the other ways the Obama administration has focused on working families is to address the long overdue issues of work-family balance. Let me take a minute today to highlight some of the more good news of the Department of Labor. It's been a decade since the last Family Medical Leave Act surveys were conducted, and you know, and I know, conditions have changed. So first, I'm proud to announce that the Wage and Hour Department will conduct a new FMLA survey in 2011. We welcome your input to make it a stronger research instrument to inform policy, enforcement, and regulations, and to reflect the full reality of the 21st century families. But we all know there are family leave needs beyond FMLA, which is why we have a great state paid leave project in our 2011 budget, and data needs beyond what the FMLA survey can tell us. So I am announcing today that in the 2011 Women's Bureau budget, we plan to sponsor a supplement to the BLS American Time Use Survey, which will focus on gathering much more data on a wide diversity of workers' access to and use of leave. We are also working to clarify how existing laws can and should apply to 21st century families. And just last month, I announced the Department of Labor's administrative interpretation of the FMLA. It clarifies that anyone who parents a child has a right to FMLA protected leave, whether that is an LGBT family or an extended family, a tia or an aunt, who steps in to care for a child because a parent is on military leave. Today, I want to further clarify that this applies to situations where we need care for our elders as well as for the children in our families. We have new wage and hour fact sheets available that clarify for workers and employers alike that a person who was the child of someone who stood in loco parentis to them has the same rights to FMLA leave to care for that parent as does a child of a biological or adoptive parent. So yes, an employee may take leave to care for his grandmother with a serious health condition if she parented him. And yes, a daughter of same-sex partnership may take leave to care for her non-adoptive or non-biological parent. These policies that address the diversity of our 21st century workplace and 21st century families are all consistent with my vision of good jobs and safe jobs for everyone. Finally, before I turn things over to my good friend Valerie Jarrett, let me just wrap up by saying that I'm very excited that the Women's Bureau, in collaboration with the White House Council on Women and Girls, will host a national dialogue on workplace flexibility. We will hold forums in Dallas, Los Angeles, Chicago, and New York with employers, advocates, unions, government officials, and other stakeholders to focus on flexibility policies in key sectors of our economy. And now it is my pleasure to introduce Valerie Jarrett, Senior Advisor to the President and the Director of the White House Council on Women and Girls.
Thank you, Hilda, Mr. Vice President, my colleagues here in the federal government, our special guest, Lilly Ledbetter, and of course, all of you. I'm just delighted to be here. And I want to begin by giving you guys a shout out for all you have done to work with us. How about a round of applause for our audience? I have the actual delight of chairing the White House Council on Women and Girls, and Tina Chin, who is the Executive Director. Tina, stand up and get a shout out. We were thrilled to be asked by the President back in March of 2009 to pull together this council that's made up of every agency in the federal government, everyone within the White House, all working at the President's direction to do everything we can to improve the quality of life and to fight hard for women and girls in every aspect of government, from our budgeting to combating domestic violence, an issue that's obviously very important to the Vice President as well, and the topics that we're discussing here today. Equal pay for women and workplace flexibility. As you've heard from my colleagues, the demographics have changed. Women are now 50% of the workforce. There are more single working moms and single working dads and two parents who are also working in the workforce. And so this isn't just an issue for women. This is an issue for the family. This is an issue for everyone. And it's an issue that's also important to the employers. And we believe that employers who recognize this change in the demographics and adjust accordingly are going to be the stronger employers looking forward into the future. Earlier this year, when we had the forum Melody described, working on workplace flexibility, Christy Romer, who chairs the President's Council of Economic Advisors, issued a report that demonstrated that flexible workplace policies can reduce employee turnover rates, increase productivity, and create a healthier bottom line for employers. So this is good for business, too. Out of the forum, one of the ideas that we came up with was creating a WorkFlex event starter kit. That's a mouthful. But the goal of this starter kit, and we want to distribute it widely, it'll be available on our website here in the White House, is to give everyone a tool that they can use to have this conversation about how to improve workplace flexibility in your communities, in your homes, with your businesses, and we want to have a national dialogue, and we'll be working with Secretary Solis as she has these events out around the country to try to get everybody engaged. We want to hear about your ideas. We want to be able to highlight best practices in both the private sector and the public sector, because we know that here at the federal government, we have to lead by example as well. And so to the degree we can improve flexibility and help these families who are trying and struggling to make ends meet and to meet the needs of their children, their elderly parents, being a part of a community, giving back to civic organizations, all of that is so important to the fabric of our country and what we're all about. And we think that with help from the federal government and with partnership with all of you, we can make a huge difference. And now I have a special pleasure. I have the pleasure of introducing someone who you all obviously know, a person who devoted years to fighting on behalf of women who were discriminated in the workplace, who pressed her case before the courts, and after there was no longer any personal benefit available for her, she fought hard with the president to pass his first bill when he became president, the Lilly Ledbetter Act. At the bill signing, the president noted this, and I quote, "Lilly didn't set out to be a trailblazer or a household name. She could have decided that it wasn't worth the hassle and the harassment that would inevitably come with speaking up for what she deserved. But instead, she decided that there was a principle at stake. There was something worth fighting for." I follow Lilly's fight over the years, and I had the privilege of getting to meet her at the bill signing and knowing her over the course of the last 19 months since then. And recently, on a personal note, I traveled to New York with my daughter, who just recently finished law school and who had been an avid follower of Lilly Ledbetter. And so she had the opportunity of actually meeting Lilly Ledbetter, her icon and her rock star. And I want to thank Lilly in front of all of you for being so gracious to my daughter and encouraging my daughter as she begins her career practicing law to keep up the good fight as well. And as I think as a mom, that the path that my daughter will follow will be just a little bit easier because of the hard work of Lilly Ledbetter. So I want to thank you for that. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You didn't want to turn it off.
Oh, okay, okay. Mr. Vice President said I didn't want to turn you off. Thank you so much. Thank you. Thank you, Valerie, for that wonderful introduction. And what an honor to be here with you and this distinguished panel on this stage. And my very honored friend, Mr. Vice President, too. Thank you, sir, for this invitation. Because I don't turn down an invitation to talk about the Lilly Ledbetter story. Because it's not just my story. It belongs to each one of you, every American family across this nation. It is your story as well. It touches someone in your family, your neighbor, someone you know, your mother, your sister, your niece, your neighbor. It touches someone, and it will touch your life. And my story is not just mine. It belongs to each of us. And I would solicit all the support in this room today for the Paycheck Fairness. Because had the Paycheck Fairness bill been law during my day, I wouldn't have had to go as far as I did. I could have asked my employer, how do I stand? How do I stand with my benefits and my coworkers? And they would have had to give me an answer without retaliation. I would have had protection from retaliation. Also, I could have talked to my coworkers around the water cooler or in the break room without retaliation. I could have learned much earlier how much less I was compensated. Because what happened to me in my case, I hired in with Goodyear Tire and Rubber Company as a first-line manager in 1979, an extremely hard job. I was a trailblazer because not many women had ever had that job, and the ones who had never lasted until retirement. I went there intending to stay at least 25 years and retire. I had a wonderful, simple plan for my life. I would work hard, I'd raise my family, I would save and build a nest egg, and when retirement came, I would settle down and enjoy the fruits of my labors. But it didn't work that way because, you see, my employer didn't live up to their end of the bargain. Goodyear decided to pay me 40% less than my male counterparts for doing the same job. And first-line managers got overtime. We were paid time and a half, double time, triple. It affected the quality of life that my family was able to have. It affected my children. It affected my husband. It affected the quality of life, education, the food, everything that involved my family. And it also had an impact on our community because I had less money to turn around and spend on my family in the community and at the college and for food and better housing, better clothing, and not have to eat so much hamburger and pinto beans down in the South. That's what happens. This is happening nationally. I travel the country now. I'm hardly ever home. And you see, while working on the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act and campaigning during the last campaign, I went home in December of 08 and found my husband deceased. He died at age 73, and that made me the other statistic that's nationally involved in this country. I'm now a widow, and my income that day dropped at my household more than 50%. But my utilities, my household costs, my yard work went up. They're extremely high. And on my income that Goodyear decided to pay me, it not only affected my quality of and family's quality of life while working, it affected on into retirement because my retirement was based on what I earned. My contributory retirement was a percentage matched at Goodyear, and my 401k was 10% matched by 6% stock. So that was all much lower. I get much lower today than I should. And then my Social Security, when I signed up, is much lower because it is also based on what I earned while working. So I won't only be a second-class citizen in their eyes for the time I work, but I will be for the rest of my life. Now, in my case, I won a federal judgment from a federal jury in Alabama, $3.8 million. Well, there's suddenly it dropped to $300,000 because that's the cap. You can only go back 2 years on equal pay. So they lowered that to $60,000. So I left the courtroom with a $360,000 award. But you see, the Goodyear appealed. We got all the way to the Supreme Court. Never in my lifetime had I ever dreamed about having a case in the Supreme Court. But that's where I found myself because I could not let it go. I was 2 years away from retirement when this started in 1998, but I couldn't let it go because it was not right. It was not what this country, anyone in this country, has a right to be treated that way, paid less than I had earned, less than what I was entitled to under the law. There's not any money in a case like this. Opponents to the Ledbetter bill and to Paycheck Fairness, they say, well, this would just start a national epidemic of lawsuits. It will not, because I can tell you firsthand, this is one of the hardest things that I have ever done, was stand up and fight for myself and now the women of this nation, because it is not easy. People don't pat you on the back like you folks did today. They usually tell you what they think and where you should be, but I do it anyway because it's for the American families across this nation. Men tell me in audiences where I speak today that they have just moved their mother in the house with them because their dad died and she can no longer get along on her earnings alone. Now that family is raising children, teenagers, and they got the mother in the house, another stress, another expense. This is not right in this nation of America. We are better than that. We're better than this. We're smarter than this. We have women who are highly educated, and they're still being compensated half what the men are paid. They cannot ask. The company I worked for said, if you discuss your pay here, you won't work here. So I'm thinking about college tuition bills coming in and utility bills, and I don't ask, because if I do, I might lose my job. I can't afford to miss that paycheck. I've got stories after stories that I have heard. I got one this morning at the bed and breakfast I'm staying at. The lady there gave me a long 2-page letter sharing her story. Hers sounds worse than mine. I just got one on my BlackBerry, an email, the lady sharing her story about her mother. And recently I had the great honor to go up to Representative Rosa DeLauro's 20th anniversary party. Had the opportunity to speak a short minute, few minutes. After it was over, the two waitresses serving there that day, they came up and wanted to know, could they just hug my neck for what I had done for them? This happens across the nation. Right after the bill was passed in the Senate, I went up to New Jersey to speak to an AAUW group at a college. And the people, the waitresses at the hotel, saw my photo on the third page of the Wall Street Journal the next day talking about the bill, and they paid for my breakfast. Now that was $12.50 and no tip. I said, look, these AAUW women, they've got a lot of money, let them pay, but They paid two mornings, so that was $25, and I don't know what the etiquette is on tipping when you don't pay your bill. But it was really good, because they said, the ladies said, I've got a daughter living back at home, and she's got a baby, and it's a girl too, and this will help them someday. I'm too far down the road, but it will help them, and thank you for what you did. And the next second day in New Jersey, the housekeeping people even lined up. So the next morning, they just wanted to meet me, someone who had fought the fight. And I can't let it go today, because I keep it alive and well, because it's time we turn this nation around. I had no idea until I got into this exactly how far behind we are in this country. But we're way behind, because in equal pay went on the books in 63, Title VII in 64. And Paycheck Fairness will make a tremendous difference. The Ledbetter bill, we just put the law back to where it was. And most people, they don't want to sue. They don't want a lawsuit. I told my husband when I started it, when I learned with the anonymous note how much less I was being paid, I said, I have got to go to Birmingham tomorrow and file a charge with EEOC unless you object. And I said, I will tell you, if I start, we'll be in it 8 years. Because there's not a quick fix in a case like this. They drag them out in corporate America. They have the money, they have the funds and the stamina to see it through. He said, what time you want to leave? And he supported me right up until his death. But I'll have to say, on behalf of what this administration has done, I love, because the EEOC in Alabama is teaching classes to around the state. And people are telling me, said, you know, we've been breaking the law every day at my workplace, and I didn't know it. And now, because they went to their classes. So they're working on the positive side. And employers, this is not something against corporate America or the employers. It is will help their business. It will improve morale. It will improve the quality of product they put out the door. It's a team effort, and it's a family affair in this nation, and we're entitled to that in this great nation of America. It's not a game. It's our real family problems. I believe today that two other things is suffering in this country as a result of women working two jobs, sometimes two, and another one on the weekend, is the obesity in the elementary levels in our education. Because mothers who talk to me about working, one mother said, I work two jobs during the week, and on the weekend I work another job on Sunday. Now she's too tired. She doesn't feel like shopping for fresh vegetables or cooking. So the kids eat whatever they can do on their own, probably fast food. She don't check on education, homework, or go to PTO meetings. She don't have time. She don't feel like it if she did have the time for the job she does. Now, this is happening in our nation, and our elderly people need to have a retirement that they can live on without having to move in with their daughter or their son's family. I thank you for this today, and I thank you for this opportunity, and please get on board and support the Paycheck Fairness, and let's get it on through the Senate and signed by the President. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Now, I give you our Vice President of the United States and a star.
If you want a definition of anticlimactic, I am it. God love you.
Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, I want to tell you, some of my good friends in here I've worked with a long, long time. I should begin by saying thank you, all of you in the audience. Valerie's right, but let me even be more specific. We would have never lasted this long without you all out there. There are some bleak years out there. There are some bleak years, and you never stopped. I really mean this. I mean this sincerely. So we, not Barack and me and this administration, we're proud of what we're doing. But the truth is, we would have been starting from a standing stop were it not for all of you. That's literally true. That is not an exaggeration. So we owe you more than you owe us by a long shot. That's number one. Number two, Ellie and others who know me well know I'm always saying to my staff, because we worked together for so many years, speak English. Literally. It's the phrase I mean, and I don't mean don't speak Spanish. I mean speak intelligibly. I literally have my staff, when they write a release for me, on anything or a speech, I say, pick up the phone and call your mother, your father, your brother, your sister, or someone you know. I mean this sincerely, not a joke. Ask a very bright lady who runs this operation for me. I literally call up, and I mean call up your educated friends. Read over the phone one time what you're suggesting I say. And if they don't understand it immediately, not a joke. Not a joke, then rewrite it. And let me tell you something. No one has to listen twice to what Lily had to say. That is the most profound explanation in the most down-to-earth, straightforward, unvarnished malarkey that, in fact, anybody could say. And you know, folks, it's really an honor to work with this crowd behind me. I mean, they have been helping me, and I hope I've been helping them since the day I stepped into this office. But some of you have been helping me a lot longer, and including Rosa DeLauro, who's been helping me for a long, long time, back in the days when she ran the Senate. The only reason Chris Dodd's the senator he is because of Rosa. And Lynn Woolsey and I have been friends for a long time. I've listened to her and a lot of others. And Jeff, I didn't see you there. I apologize. Jeff Merkley is new, but he ain't slow, man. He's gotten out of the box really quickly. And there's so many other people here to recognize. Kim Gandy, Pat Roos, and Ellie, we've been longtime friends, and they've educated me a lot, and I mean that literally, educated me a lot, and so many other of you who are leaders in the community. Folks, to me, this is a pretty simple proposition. This is not really complicated, and I mean this sincerely. It's a pretty simple proposition. I love our friends on the other side who talk about being pro-family. This is the single most profound pro-family initiative that there is out there today. Look, when the president asked me to set up the middle class task force, which I was honored to do, the truth of the matter is, the economist, when I'd be out in fora, they'd say, define for me what constitutes the middle class. And we can get in these arguments, is it the medium income, is it $49,250, here's what middle class is, to me, where I come from. Middle class is being able to live in a safe neighborhood, live in a decent home that you can heat and you can air condition if you're in a hot climate, live in a place where your kids can walk the streets, where you have a promise. I don't know, I've never met a single man or woman from a barrio to a ghetto to a wealthy neighborhood who hasn't wanted to send their child to college. I've not met one yet. I have not met one yet. To have a fighting chance to be able to give your kids something you didn't have and to live in a place where the environment is decent. Folks, that's what middle class is, to me anyway. From Scranton and Claymont, that's what middle class is. It's, in a sense, nothing more and nothing less. But what it does take, it takes a decent income to be able to meet that criteria. And there's so many people aspiring to the middle class, and so many people the last decade falling out of the middle class. And you know, it's a little like Ellie and I were talking about. We had a couple events on Title IX, which I'm very proud to have been some association with, and Ellie and others have been leaders on, many of you in this room, although none of you will admit to be old enough to have any part in Title IX, I know. But I kid about it. You know, the one thing about Title IX that was so profound is all the guys I grew up with who were good athletes, and I presumptuously counted myself among them, all of a sudden found out when they had a talented daughter who was a good athlete, how ferociously supportive they became of Title IX. Not a joke. Not a joke. Not a joke. I remember one of my best friends, actually my best friend, great athlete, when I was pushing Title IX, when I was running for the county council in 70 and then the United States Senate, he was like, grumbling. He had two daughters who were all state athletes, and he still is complaining about the fact they did not get enough out of Title IX. So it's amazing. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I would argue, and my staff kids me about this, I always say reality has a way of intruding in politics. Well, reality has intruded on this issue of fair pay. Because ultimately, ladies and gentlemen, this comes down to a simple proposition. It comes down to a quality of life issue, not just, as Lily pointed out, for the woman, but for everyone around her. Everyone around her. And it's being felt in a way that's biting now with this god-awful recession that we inherited. Ladies and gentlemen, when the President and I got to the White House, one of the very first things we did, as has been pointed out, is the President signed the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act. But as Lily points out, that just established the laws that was supposed to be a long, long time ago. And we set up the Middle Class Task Force. And we set one goal above all else, to make sure that those aspire to the middle class have a fighting chance, and to make sure those who are in it are able to stay. And so far, our efforts have been working. In the last 6 months of the Bush administration, we lost 3 million jobs. In the first 6 months before our economic policy could even get up and running, notwithstanding the courageous help of the Democratic Congress, it just took time to get it moving, we lost an additional 3.6 million jobs. Before I lowered my hand on that day with a million faces looking up with expectation, hope, and little anxiety on the mall, we had already lost that month 740,000 jobs. Well, in the last 6 months of our administration, with President Obama's leadership, we have created 600,000 private sector jobs. And as Nancy Pelosi, who I've been campaigning around the country with for Democratic candidates, we were together yesterday in Philadelphia, pointed out, that's more jobs than was created in all 8 years of the Bush administration. So, ladies and gentlemen, as bleak as it is out there, we have turned this mighty, this gigantic super tank around that was just wandering out to sea, and it's heading back to port. It's moving in the right direction. We've gone from an economy that was shrinking at 6.4% when we took office to one the last three quarters that has grown at an average of 3.5%. But I realize we're nowhere near where we have to be. There's still too much pain. There's still too many families out there feeling the brunt of this crisis, and still too much unfairness and inequity in the way men and women are compensated for their work. I understand that we had a bunch of mindless mortgages given out over the past few years, but banks shouldn't be doing what they're doing now, some banks, using those mistakes to justify more mindless, heartless policies now. Mothers on maternity leaves have jobs. They have income. And they shouldn't have to lose their deal to close on a house because they had a baby, which is now what some banks are doing, as you read in the paper this morning. Some banks are even turning down mortgages for people on paid leave. That's simply wrong, and it needs to stop. Look, the American workforce looks very different, as Hilda pointed out, than it did even two decades ago. Two-income families are the norm now. They're not the exception. And older workers are staying in the workforce longer than they did before. And men and women are more evenly sharing financial responsibilities within a family. Ironically, this recession hit men worse than women in the workplace. It was predicted it would be the opposite. But when you think about it, it's not surprising, because women are lower paid, so they were able to stay on. You want to get a man to figure out why it's in his interest that there be equal pay, have him lose a job and turn around and find out his wife, who's the sole income wage earner in that family, is making 40% less than a worker doing the same job. I would have been mildly upset when my wife was a school teacher and now a professor at a community college and working and still full-time doing 15 credits if I found out her male counterpart with the same doctorate degree was getting even 1% more. Not that I have a temper, but I might very well show up. So my point is this, folks. We're reaching a critical mass here. Ironically, my mom used to have an expression, out of everything bad, something good will come if you look hard enough for it. Maybe what we're going to be beginning to see now is a realization, now that this bites at home, that we're not only going to list the activist women in the country have been so involved for so long, and women generally, but a whole lot of men who up to now did not view this issue in the same terms, they now understand it, because it's real. It's been pointed out many times, women make up half of the workers in the U.S. payrolls, and two-thirds of the families with children are headed either by two working parents or by a single parent who works. Yet the workplace has, for the most part, not changed to reflect those realities. In closing the gender pay gap, helping parents keep their jobs while balancing creative responsibilities and caregiving responsibilities, and increasing workplace flexibility are no longer women's issues. They are now issues of the middle class economic security. I mean, they literally are. They literally are. When American families depend on a woman's wages, eliminating pay discrimination also is good economic policy and good family policy. You know, with the progress, even the progress we made, some 50 years after the passage of the Equal Pay Act, as has been pointed out time and again, but it's worth reminding the press from the Vice President, women still get paid 77 cents on the dollar that every man earns, with a bigger wage gap for, I might add, for women of color. It's even a larger wage gap. And today, we continue to work to close that gap. But just like in every other movement, there comes times where there's an inflection point, where we go from making incremental progress to making significant progress. It is my hope. I know I'm an optimist. Everybody says, well, and by the way, I've been hanging around this town longer than a lot of people. I'm not an optimist born out of my silly Irish optimism. I'm an optimist because I know the history, the journey of this country. That's how it works. Because of the incredible work of all of you, I really think we're on the cusp of really having the same kind of fundamental change take place as we did with the Civil Rights Acts back in the 60s, where the mindset changes as well. We still have a long way to go there, but where the mindset changes. You heard from others about improving coordination, collecting better data, engaging in public education campaigns, making the federal government a model for others looking to close the pay gap. All of these steps are necessary, but there are by no means sufficient to solve the problem. We simply can't solve the problem without an additional change in legislation. And Rosa, you and your colleagues, and George Miller, I might add, you have stepped up in a way, and you did it early on, and passed the Paycheck Fairness Act. We're all familiar with the stories of the woman who starts at a lower salary base and then her male peer and never catches up, even if after that things get better. The woman who doesn't receive the same raise as a man does, and Lily knows better in a way, never knows it, and some of you probably experienced that as well. A woman who isn't invited to conference and dinners and then doesn't receive a promotion because she wasn't there. The woman who never knows what someone else makes and how much less she makes than her peers because she can't discuss it and it can't be discussed by anybody. Look, as Lily pointed out in very graphic and straightforward terms, the Paycheck Fairness Act gives women more tools to get fair pay. It basically, what it does is say, hey, let me know what the field is. Let me know what the playing field is. Let me know what the deal is. We're not asking employers to do anything. Just let us know. And it's amazing what a disinfectant sunlight is. It's amazing what a disinfectant it is. You know, ladies and gentlemen, the fear of reprisal has been a tool of intimidation that's been used by people with power ever since, from time immemorial. But this would, in fact, bring some sunlight in. It would close loopholes that make it hard for women to challenge being paid different wages for the same work. For example, allowing an employer to argue the defense that a man is paid more because he has a better negotiating skills and prevents comparisons of employees in different facilities in the same towns. It will eliminate all that malarkey. That's been used as a dodge. Most employers, were beginning to understand that for productivity, for their bottom line, for them to be able to, in fact, compete more around the world, it makes sense for them to do this. But you still have the Chamber of Commerce, you still have these folks purporting to represent business, and I'm sure they do represent business in part. But there's an awful lot of employers who want to get this straightened out and don't want to be at a competitive disadvantage. Look, this ensures that women who prove their case are compensated fairly. The House already passed this legislation, and now I'm here to say publicly what Senator Merkley has been pushing up in the Senate, and that is, get on with it. Get on with it. Really, I say to all those few Democrats and all those Republicans who are, at least thus far, have said no or said nothing, This is your chance, and I mean this sincerely, to get in the right side of history. This is a chance. This is one of those votes. This is one of those votes that in the minds of the economists isn't fundamentally going to alter whether or not we get out of this out of this god-awful recession faster. It's not going to determine whether or not we have the right policy in Afghanistan or whether or not we're going to avoid a nuclear meltdown somewhere. But guess what it is? It is an issue that you're going to have to look into the eyes of your granddaughters, and you're going to have to look in the eyes of the young women who you have hired, the young women who, in fact, are equally as qualified as any man you've ever hired, and say, you know, when it came time, I didn't step up. I really mean it. I really mean it. Because I can tell you, some of the guys who voted against Title IX, they had to look at their daughters and granddaughters and answer that question. You know, where were you, Grandpa, when the decision? I really mean this. I know it sounds very parochial, but I really think this is one of the deals where the tide of history is moving. Get in the right side. Get in the right side now. Pass this act. Make sure that this issue, which is a moral issue, is a civil rights issue, is also, most importantly, a family issue. Everybody's going to be held accountable, not by some historian grading this, but in your personal life, in your personal life, the women you say you care about, the daughters you say you care about, the granddaughters you say you care about. Step up, man. Step up and change the law. Thank you very much.
You are good. You are good.